Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present three-time independent presidential candidate Ralph Nader, who discusses his impressions of the Occupy Wall Street movement and the threat it poses to the political and economic status quo. Ellen Miller of the Sunshine Foundation, who explains why her group is advocating that members of the Congressional Deficit Supercommittee fully disclose all campaign contributions received during the critical final weeks of the panel's deliberations. And best-selling author and farmer Ben Hewitt, who talks about his personal commandments for creating a sustainable local food system and the value of crop diversity in small-scale farming. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories. The late October election in Tunisia marked a key turning point in the year-long Arab Spring of popular uprisings. Attention is shifting from mass protests to elections and the writing of new constitutions. In the process, there is growing worry among secular activists about the rights of women and religious minorities. In Tunisia, where the Arab Spring began, the Islamist party al-Nahda won 41% of the vote and pledged to form a new coalition government. But the surge for the Islamic bloc surprised many Arab secular and minority groups who were at the forefront of street protests. Egyptians will vote on November 28th to elect a new parliament, which will write a new constitution. Concern about the right of religious minorities surfaced in Egypt after 27 Coptic Christians were killed by the army during protests in Cairo. And in post-Qaddafi Libya, the interim government has established Sharia, or Islamic law, which will oversee marriage and family law. In Syria, opponents of President Bashar al-Assad have splintered between secular groups and the Muslim Brotherhood over the future role of Islam in a post-Assad government. Meanwhile, pro-democracy activists have to contend with the clout of Saudi Arabia and other Persian Gulf countries that are funding Islamic political parties. Saudi money comes with the expectation that recipients will promote the teachings of Saudi-influenced Wahhabism, a harsh form of Islam associated with jihadist groups. Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos has abolished that South American nation's scandal-ridden intelligence agency, the Administration Security Department, or DAS. For the last 2 years, reports of illegal spying have led to the indictment of two DAS directors and charges against Bernardo Morena, the chief of staff of former Colombian President Alberto Uribe, during a long probe over illegal phone tapping. In mid-September, former DAS director Jorge Noguera was sentenced to 25 years in jail for collaborating with right-wing paramilitary death squads. As spy chief under Uribe, Noguera let death squads infiltrate DAS and gave them access to intelligence on labor and community activists who were subsequently murdered. Colombia's right-wing paramilitary groups have long been leading perpetrators of human rights violations. Former intelligence director Maria del Pilar Hurtado was indicted in the probe, fled the country, and was given political asylum in Panama. More than 20 people who worked for DAS have been indicted or convicted for abusing power within the intelligence agency since 2009. Large U.S.-based multinational corporations, including Apple, Oracle, and Pfizer, are lobbying Congress for a tax holiday on $1 trillion they hold overseas. The corporate lobbying effort, endorsed by over 70 members of Congress, including leading Democrats like Senator Barbara Boxer, say the holiday would bring billions of dollars back to America and boost new investment and jobs. On the flip side, the tax holiday could cost American taxpayers $40 to $80 billion over the next decade. Studies suggest that over 70% of the money returned to the U.S. would end up as bonuses for top corporate executives or in the pockets of shareholders. During a 2004 tax repatriation holiday, corporate earnings returned from overseas were taxed at 5.25% instead of the standard 35% corporate income tax rate. Critics in Congress, like Michigan Senator Carl Levin, complain that such tax holidays punish companies that rely on domestic production. According to the Center for Public Integrity, the bulk of tax benefits from the 2004 tax holiday went to 15 big corporations. By themselves, Pfizer, Merck, Hewlett-Packard, Johnson & Johnson, and IBM brought back $88 billion in corporate cash to the U.S. at the reduced tax rate. A U.S. Senate investigation discovered that Intel and Coca-Cola used shell companies in the Cayman Islands to hide corporate cash. Tax analyst Charles Kingson said the tax holiday, quote, rewards those who have beaten the tax system. What Intel or GE or Pfizer does not pay, other people and their children will. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
With thousands of new activists participating in hundreds of encampments across the nation each week, the Occupy Wall Street movement is moving forward, even if the eventual goals and list of demands are not yet clear. The November 2nd general strike in Oakland, California, called on short notice to respond to police violence, organized thousands of activists to march downtown and close down the city's busy container port. Many observers were struck by the success of that citywide action and diversity of participants, demonstrating the power of this new movement that wasn't even in existence just 2 short months ago. Now, with ongoing police challenges to occupy encampments in dozens of cities and towns, derisive media stories focusing on drug use and sex, and preparations for the cold winter ahead, many activists are sitting down to contemplate longer-term strategies on how to grow the movement and more effectively disseminate their message protesting corporate greed, political corruption, and economic inequality. Many longtime progressive activists and intellectuals from across the U.S. have offered support to the Occupy movement and have visited encampments to conduct teach-ins and provide advice if asked. Ralph Nader is among them. The 3-time independent presidential candidate credits this new movement with changing the national conversation from one focused on austerity to unaccountable corporate crime and abuse. The protesters' grievances echo Nader's primary message through his 5-decade career as a consumer advocate, citizen activist, and candidate. Your reporter spoke with Ralph Nader about his impressions of the Occupy Wall Street movement and the threat it poses to the political and economic status quo.
Well, I think it's the early stages of repealing a long-repressed demand for justice. You know, you can't live in this country and see all those great reports on corporate crime and the control over our government and big money buying politicians and Wall Street crashes on the backs of workers and investors and taxpayer bailouts without having to, you know, start churning your core of decency and what you think a fair play is among people in a country like ours. And I think this came out of nowhere. In the sense that no one could really have predicted this. I wrote a column, and you can see it on Nader.org, a few months ago, right after the Tunisian breakthrough and Egyptian breakthrough. And I said, you never know where the spark's going to come from. And when it comes, people are going to say, wow, how amazing. What took us so long? Well, the spark, basically, was young people. Usually starts with people in their 20s who are willing to camp out and march and engage in nonviolent civil disobedience and be arrested. And they took over public space. They took over the commons. And in so doing now, they planted themselves in dozens and dozens of communities, right down to Niles, Michigan, which has 12,000 people. And their signs indicate what they are going for, which is a broad range of justice, the deconcentration of corporate power, the end of the bailouts, a complete shift of public budget priorities to the needs and necessities of tens of millions of Americans, a public works program, getting out of those criminal wars. I mean, this is a very fundamental movement, so much so that some of the Tea Partiers who visited the Occupy New York area in Zuccotti Park were ready for a friendly argument, and they went away agreeing with Occupy Wall Street people on about 5 major issues.
Ralph, we've just saw on November 5th a transfer of over 600,000 accounts from the big banks to smaller community banks and credit unions. In your opinion,
are the elite powers that be in the U.S. threatened by the Occupy Wall Street movement, and how seriously do they take the threat presented by this movement to the economic and political status quo?
Well, I think some of them made fun of the movement at the beginning, and others, I think, felt that they had some grievance. You had some surprising statements of approval by some Republicans. But I think now, Scott, they're beginning to sweat a bit. I think when they see movements away from big banks to community banks, that's language these big bankers understand. And if it wasn't for the fact that so many people who have these bank accounts also have electronic payment connections where their, you know, their electric and telephone and other bills are paid electronically, it would be much easier to move. So it takes a while for them to disconnect, and that's why it's so impressive that 650,000 people in less than 2 months have moved away from these banks to credit unions. And if that starts going, and more people vote with their consumer feet, they're not going to be laughing anymore. These business bosses will be starting to buy more underarm deodorant.
That's good for them. It could be good for the cosmetic industry, too, I guess. I wanted to ask your opinion on the targeting of Congress. You recently wrote a column suggesting that the Occupy Wall Street movement might encircle the offices of members of Congress, especially those ones who are standing in the way of some common sense reforms and structural changes to this very unfair system. What's your view on that?
Yeah, I think that's the next stage. They're looking for more Occupy sites for demonstrations, and I'm urging them, because they are so decentralized, the Occupy initiatives, to surround many of the 535 offices of their senators and representatives back home. And, you know, just look in the phone book under U.S. Congress, and you'll see where they are, the offices, and you surround them just the way 10,000 people surrounded the White House to try to persuade President Obama to block the XL pipeline. And I think if they do that, the bubble in Congress, I mean, Congress has hardly felt this. I mean, they're still going about their oligarchic and plutocratic and narcissistic and ignorant activities there on Capitol Hill. They haven't yet felt it, but I think that's the next stage that they should go through. These people are very computer savvy. They've lived for years in virtual reality, looking at screens, and now they know that the action really is in physical reality. It's in reality on the ground, here, there, everywhere. If they maintain their discipline and their nonviolent, open civil disobedience, they will continue to generate that kind of moral authority.
That was Ralph Nader, consumer advocate, citizen activist, and three-time independent presidential candidate. His newest book is titled Getting Steam to Overcome Corporatism, Build It Together to Win. Find links to Nader's commentaries and information on the Occupy Wall Street movement on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The Congressional Joint Select Committee on Deficit Reduction, known as the Congressional Super Committee, was formed in a deal reached to break the impasse over raising the nation's debt ceiling in August. The Super Committee, composed of 6 Democrats and 6 Republicans, half from the House and half from the Senate, are tasked with reducing the nation's deficit by at least $1.2 trillion over the next 10 years by making budget cuts and or increasing revenue. The panel's members must reach an agreement on a deficit reduction plan by November 23rd, which would then be voted on by the full Congress. If the panel cannot broker a deal, that failure would trigger automatic cuts by the same amount in both domestic and defense spending in the 2013 federal budget. The odds against the committee reaching a deal are high, since GOP lawmakers have rejected all tax hikes on the wealthy that President Obama and Democratic legislators say must be linked to any major cuts in Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. Because of the enormous amounts of money at stake in these negotiations for defense contractors, health insurance companies, and other special interests, their lobbyists are working feverishly to influence the outcome of the Super Committee's mostly secret deliberations. Your reporter spoke with Ellen Miller, co-founder and executive director of the Sunshine Foundation. Miller explains why her group is advocating for full disclosure of all campaign contributions received and meetings held between lobbyists and members of the Super Committee or their staff during the critical final weeks of the panel's negotiations.
Some might believe that the task set to the Super Committee is so enormous that there's almost no one who will be unaffected. I mean, we're talking about, the figure I tend to use is $1.2 trillion that either will have to be cut or raised through new revenues. That's a lot of money. That will mean that every program we care about, whether it's Social Security or healthcare or schools or defense, across the board, there will be a dramatic change in the amount of government money that is going to support these kinds of programs. So every one of us should be concerned, and every one of us should have the opportunity to comment to our representatives about how we think this should happen. But in fact, the committee is operating outside the reach of public oversight. It's having mostly secret hearings. Occasionally they've had a few window dressing hearings where they are open to the public. But the decisions are all being made behind closed doors, except to those who can afford to hire lobbyists and those who can afford to give big campaign contributions. So it's really critical, we think, for all Americans to have the ability to track online in real time the lobbying activities and every dollar of campaign contributions that are coming into committee's members, because we are concerned that the lobbyists with their campaign money will have a determinative outcome on the decisions that are made. We don't know whether that's true or not, but without real transparency, 21st century style transparency, we will always suspect that that's the case. And so we're anxious for the committee members to comply with what we've asked for, which would be voluntary, to list all of their campaign contributions and all their meetings with lobbyists every single day that they're meeting.
Ellen Miller, the super committee has on its docket to consider major cuts in defense spending as well as social safety net programs like Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. What are the institutions and corporations in this country that have a vested interest in determining the outcome of what this super committee recommends?
We know that in the first quarter that, you know, $100,000 has been raised in contributions to 10 of the 12 members of the super committee or their leadership PACs. We know that there are now over 600 lobby registrants that have listed the Budget Control Act, which was the act that actually set up the super committee, as something they're lobbying on. 600 lobby registrants. I mean, imagine the pressure that these members of Congress are under. We know that some of the largest lobbying groups involve healthcare organizations, communications and electronic industries, the finance and insurance industry. You know, those are the top three that are lobbying. But everyone is there. Everyone who has the potential of either having taxes raised on them or programs cut is lobbying this committee. Now, to some degree, one might say if everyone is there and everyone is represented. But in fact, you know, most people are not represented by these heavy-hitting big corporations. Most people aren't represented at all when it comes to role of money in politics. I looked at this figure earlier today and realized that less than 1% of Americans make a campaign contribution of $1,000. But that money is determinative in terms of who gets elected. And so, you know, if you have big money to give or to hire high-paid lobbyists, you obviously are getting better representation in this process.
Ellen, what are you suggesting right now in terms of disclosure from the members of the super committee so that the public will have a better idea of the moneyed interests and the influence that they're wielding on the members of this committee? They're going to make some really major decisions for the near-term and long-term future of the country.
Well, we've asked for really three very simple things. Number one, for members of the super committee to voluntarily disclose their campaign contributions, to voluntarily disclose their lobbying contacts, the meetings they're having, and finally, to post their recommendations 72 hours before the final committee vote so that people understand what's in the bill, they can read the legislation, and they can contact the members of Congress and tell them what they think about it. So three very simple things. Put your campaign contributions online in real time, tell us who you're meeting with, and put the legislation online so we can look at it before you vote on it. But there's a general reluctance from members of Congress to call on other members of Congress, in fact, to disclose what they really don't want to disclose. For the very same reasons we want the information, which is we want the information so we can demand accountability, members of Congress are reluctant to give us that information.
That was Ellen Miller,
co-founder and executive director of the Sunshine Foundation. Learn more about the Sunshine Foundation's campaign for government transparency by visiting our website at btlonline.org. This year's Connecting for Change East Coast Pioneers Conference took place from October 21st to the 23rd in New Bedford, Massachusetts. The Marion Institute, that has sponsored the conference for 7 years now, describes the gathering as bringing together environmental, industry, and social justice innovators to focus on food and farming, health and healing, green business, indigenous knowledge, spirituality, and sustainability, all working to catalyze a movement to heal our world. Ben Hewitt, one of the keynote speakers at this year's Connecting for Change conference, is a best-selling author and farmer from northern Vermont, where he runs a 40-acre diversified farm with his family. He lives with his wife and two sons in a self-built home that's powered by a windmill and solar photovoltaic panels. In his talk, Hewitt described the difficulties of small-scale farming, but also about how small-scale agriculture and the growing local food movement has pumped new life into towns like Hardwick, Vermont, the subject of his book, The Town That Food Saved. After his speech, Hewitt spoke with Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus about his own personal commandments for creating a sustainable local food system and explained the value of crop diversity in a small setting.
My four rules, or the four commandments of local food, you know, number one is it should feed the locals. You know, it seems sort of self-evident, I guess, if you're talking about local food systems. Number two is that it should be circular. So the idea is that, you know, I think right now most people, 99% of us in this country sort of eat from what I call a straight line food system, which is where you have a bunch of inputs on one end, mostly non-renewable. You have this, you know, food shipped through this sort of convoluted system. The average calorie travels about 1,500 miles in the U.S. before it reaches ultimately a stomach. And then at the other end, you have an enormous quantity of waste. So about 40% of the food in this country is wasted. So what I'm talking about is that, you know, sort of a circular system that seeks to close the loop is the term that's often used in conjunction with recycling. You know, I'm talking about sort of doing the same thing with food. So, you know, finding a way to create, it's a lot of people call it a food web, where you have people, you know, in different points around that circle in connection with one another, producer to customer to retailer to composting facility to, you know, wherever. Rule number three is that it should be based on sunshine. It's pretty simple, but basically, you know, right now agriculture as a sector is the leading user of energy in this country, and of course, you know, most of that energy is derived from finite resources. And so the idea that it's going to be based on sunshine is simply to say that, you know, we're going to use renewable inputs to make this system work. And then number four, the last one, again, according to me, is that it should offer viability to the producers. So the idea that, you know, doesn't really do anyone any good to create a local food system where the producers can't make a livelihood from it. I'm not saying that these rules all work in a particularly symbiotic way, because right now I think, with the state of the food economy and the food system in this country, and really probably in some cases globally, a couple of those rules really stand in sort of contradiction of each other, and that's number one and number four. And, you know, if you're going to be producing food in a way that sort of honors, you know, the circularity and the sunshine commandments, you're probably going to have to be charging a price. You're basically operating in what I, you know, call sort of an honest economic sphere. You're making a true honest accounting for your impacts and your environmental impacts. You're not sort of externalizing all your costs. And that puts you in a tricky spot in terms of trying to price your food so that locals can afford it.
And now you are a farmer yourself.
That's correct. Yeah, we have a small farm. We have 40 acres, and we do a little bit of beef and pork. I guess the way I describe it is sort of a turn of the century Vermont hill farm, but not the most recent turn of the century. So it's what I, you know, think a lot of farms might have looked like in, you know, in 1900, which is going back quite a ways. But it's very small in scale. It's very diversified. And we pretty much sell only direct to consumer.
So one of the things, you know, you talked about the necessity of diversity and because locals don't want to eat just one food item. Just talk a little bit more about that, and also if you could touch on the restaurant that's up there and how they deal with that or how they accommodate that.
You know, I think diversity is an issue that comes up when we talk about small-scale food systems for precisely the reason you mentioned, which is if you're really trying to feed locals and if the locals are really invested in sort of supporting it, well, it doesn't make a lot of sense to have five different cheesemakers. Cheese is delicious, but, you want to be able to eat more than that. But there's also, I think, some less obvious reasons that we really need to think about the issue of diversity. And one is that whole issue of creating this sort of circular system because, of course, every product is going to require different inputs. And so if you have, we see this a lot, I think, right now in agriculture in our country where you have regions sort of specializing. You know, Vermont specializes in cheese and, a lot of regions specializing in wine and, whatever it is that they sort of wherever they find their niche. And I think the problem with that, at least particularly on a smaller scale, is that you begin to overwhelm a region's ability to provide the inputs for that particular agricultural practice, whatever it is. The other thing that diversity does that I think is really important is it offers an opportunity for different producers to utilize each other's waste streams. And I'm just going to give you a really small example from our own farm. We raise pigs, right? Not a lot. We raise about a half dozen or eight pigs a year. But we raise them almost exclusively on waste milk from local dairy farms. Now, if there were four or five other people raising, even in our small community, but this works on any scale, my point is true of almost any scale, if there were more people raising pigs in our community, there wouldn't be enough waste milk to support all of those pigs. So we're utilizing a waste resource that if, Cabot were all of a sudden the, the pig production capital of Vermont would no longer work and people would have to be buying in a lot of grain to feed the pigs as opposed to doing it on this sort of small scale and utilizing this waste resource. One other point about diversity, and I think it's really key, is that if you have diversity in producers and they're producing different products, you really start to step away from the sense that they're in competition with each other and create opportunities for collaboration. And we have a very, in this country, we're sort of, raised to believe that, we have a competitive business economy, and that's, that's the way we're brought up and what we're taught. But the reality is, I think, for these systems to work and to sort of maximize the efficiency, we need a lot of collaboration. And so a diversity of products, I think, really sort of goes a long way toward making that happen.
That was Ben Hewitt, a best-selling author and small farmer from northern Vermont. Find more information on Hewitt's books and the Bioneers Connecting for Change conference on our website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by writing us at mail@btlonline.org. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine, and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.